Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for standing by. Welcome to the EY Banking Union conference call. During today's presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Please press star zero for operator assistance at any time. This conference is being recorded today, June 1st, 2016. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Henrik Axelsson. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. This is Henrik Axelsson, EY's Banking Union leader. I'm delighted to be joining you today and want to welcome you to our third Banking Union call. We have more than 160 people on the line today from 23 countries, and we plan for today's discussion to be interactive. So this is our third update on important developments in the Banking Union, and today we have three main topics. One is the minimum required eligible liabilities, also called MREL. The second is the key challenges in the market coming up around the European Central Bank's targeted review of internal models, the so-called TRIM program. And the third is recent regulatory developments around the European Deposit Insurance Scheme, now under the acronym EDIS, the third leg of the Banking Union. We'd love to hear what's on your mind, so please email any questions to us at bankingunion@uk.ey.com. And thanks to those of you who already emailed us some questions for the panel. Also joining me today is our three panelists, Mario Delgado, a partner for financial regulation, former head of the international coordination at FROB, the Spanish Executive Resolution Authority, who will be leading our discussion on MREL.
Thank you, Henrik. It's a pleasure to be here today.
And we have Frank de Jonge. He's a partner in Brussels leading our European Quantitative Advisory Services team, and he will lead our discussion on TRIM.
Thanks, Henrik. It's an honor to represent the risk modeling community here today.
And finally, Dr. David Doyle, who is our senior policy advisor from our financial services regulation team, who will lead our discussion on EDIS.
Yes, good morning. I'm delighted to be part of the call.
All right. Following our three sessions, which will take exactly half an hour, then we'll have a Q&A session. Again, if you have questions, please email them to us at bankingunion@uk.ey.com. So with that, let's open. Over to you, Mario.
Thank you, Henrik, and good morning again, everybody. Since the very beginning of the discussions on the new resolution framework, the MREL requirement has been one of the hottest issues. And that's easy to understand, given that this requirement constitutes a constraint on the liabilities structures of entities and will likely have implications on their funding costs. There are five dimensions of MREL that I would like to go through in today's call. First, the timeline ahead. Second, the required amount. Third, the eligibility of liabilities. Fourth, location within the group, and fifth, disclosure. The main legal reference is the recently adopted Delegated Act by the European Commission. However, there are two additional references in the pipeline. The mandated EBA report on implementation on MREL, expected for October 2016, and the expected proposal of the European Commission for harmonizing MREL and TLAC, expected for the end of the year. Which leads us to today's first message, which is that there's still a degree of uncertainty on the final MREL terms, and this will affect the entity's plans towards compliance. Now we start with the first of the 5 points we are going to cover, timeline. Early this year, the SRB indicated that MREL would be set in quarter three and quarter four of 2016 for the entities under its responsibility. And those remain the official deadlines. Still, they may turn out to be ambitious, at least for some banks. The reason is that the resolution authority needs to develop a deep understanding of its entity's resolvability in order to set the MREL, and it takes time to develop that understanding. Additionally, the period for compliance is still open. The EBA had proposed 48 months in its draft regulatory technical standards. However, that explicit phase-in has been dropped in the final Delegated Act by the European Commission, and now the transition period will be as short as possible and left to the resolution authority's discretion. As a reference, we can say that TLAC sets a two-stages transition period. with 2019 as the year to comply with the lower requirement and 2022 for the higher requirement. Given that MREL will be set at the end of this year, complying by, for example, 1st January 2019 would imply having just 2 years to cover the gap. Second point I want to cover, amount of MREL. This is a great unknown, since we only know for sure that, unlike TLAC's Pillar 1, MREL will be set on a case-by-case basis. Still, there are useful references that entities can have in mind as benchmarks for their internal analysis. The first one is the famous 8% of total assets, which is the minimum bail-in required before access to the resolution fund is possible. This was a reference for the MREL for G-SIBs and D-SIBs in the EBA version of the regulatory technical standards, but it has been removed in the Commission Delegated Act. Nevertheless, the SRB has stated in several occasions that it will be some sort of default starting point. Another reference are the TLAC requirements, 16% of risk-weighted assets by 2019 and 18% by 2022, in both cases with the possibility of a case-by-case Pillar 2 add-on. A final reference is doubling ordinary capital requirements, which will be usually higher than the other references. Still, in this case, adjustments should be foreseen to account for balance sheet depletion or for the possibility that it is not necessary to recapitalize the whole entity again. 3. Eligibility. The expected proposal by the European Commission on harmonization of MREL and TLAC leaves this point open again. One of the main elements is whether subordination of MREL will be required as it is in TLAC. This would also help to overcome the potential problems derived from the different hierarchy of liabilities that's being set across countries. The European Commission proposal is expected for late this year, and then it will need to be discussed and approved with the Council and the Parliament, which means that entities might need to start complying with MREL without a perfect picture of what liabilities will be ultimately eligible. Fourth point, location within the group. The BRRD is clear in stating that MREL needs to be required at its legal entity level. The SRB has been asked several times whether it would make sense that, for Eurogroups, MREL should be only located at the parent level. The justification would be that given that there is a banking union with a single rule book and single authorities, it could make sense that entities in that area are treated as a whole. So far, even if the SRB has shown sympathy to that reason, the reasoning, they have stated that it is difficult because of certain remaining national differences. For example, DGS are still national, although David will later on develop on the progress to develop a European scheme. Secondly, insolvency laws are also national. And as I said, there are different hierarchies of liabilities. Therefore, we should keep expecting MREL being set at the legal entity level, also within the EU area. The fifth and final point is disclosure. A representative from the SRB has recently said that she does not believe that individual MREL requirements should necessarily be made public. She justified that by saying that what it is essential for investors to know and understand is not the exact individual requirement, but two things. The first one, to have a clear view of the liabilities structure of the entity in which they are considering investing. And then, the second one, an understanding of where the security they are considering investing in lies within that structure. Because what is relevant for investors to judge the risk they are taking is the buffer of liabilities that lies before that security, and that would be bailed in an eventual resolution for the absorption of losses or for conversion of debt into equity. Now, I would like to conclude with a few remarks on what entities can do to prepare for MREL. The first thing would be to enhance information systems and management. MREL is not going to be monitored not only by authorities, but internally too. So detailed and accurate information should be at hand. The second line of action is working on resolvability. If the resolution authority feels confident that the resolution of the entity would be feasible and simple, it could be comfortable with a lower embroiled requirement. Finally, entities can work on embroiled scenarios and see what the gap would be in each of those, and then start thinking of a compliance plan. In sum, there are still relevant uncertainties around MREL, but there are also useful actions that entities can already work on to prepare for it. That's all by now. Thank you for your attention. I'll be happy to take questions later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mario. And now on the topic of TRIM, over to you, Frank.
Yeah, thank you, Hendrik, and good morning again to all of you. So when the SSM did the comprehensive assessment back in 2014, the big topic that was not included in comparison to the asset quality reviews that the Troika had been doing during the financial crisis was the actual audit and benchmarking of the risk-weighted assets on the basis of internal models and comparisons thereof. So about a year ago, the SSM launched the model quality review, later renamed the TRIM, the targeted review of internal models, on the back of several comparative studies by the Basel Committee of Banking Supervision and other regulatory and supervisory bodies with respect to RWA and RWA variability. As we speak, early in June 2016, the work has started in earnest with a huge fact-finding phase. Roughly speaking, this fact-finding phase is likely to last till the end of 2016, with more intrusive on-site reviews of the models taking place in the subsequent years 2017-2018. It's good to notice that the challenge is huge. Whatever the definition of the exact scope of the number of models, there are several thousands of them. And to make it tangible, if you would want to review 2,000 models and spending on average 50 man days per model, that would be 400 man-year of work. So it's clearly a huge undertaking that the SSM has taken on. So a risk-based approach will determine most likely where the SSM will go in more depth in those subsequent years. A blanket coverage of all the models does not seem feasible from a purely logistical point of view. On the basis of conversations with our clients and presentations from different representatives of supervisory bodies, we conclude that the following are the objectives of the TRIM. First of all, to perform a robust reassessment of the overall regulatory compliance of previously approved internal models. As my experience working with colleagues in different countries clearly shows, accepted market practices in the modeling minutiae, so really deep down in the details of the models, can differ significantly with significant impact on the final capital estimates. Second objective would be the establishment of best practices, in particular for areas where regulation is unclear, and also with respect to the rigor of implementation, for instance, when it comes to the governance aspects around models and model change management. Thirdly, confirmation of adequate conservativeness in the risk models and hence also in the risk-weighted assets. Are known sources of model risk adequately reflected in conservatism and can we document and argue that? And a final objective is actually to come to actionable remediation plans at an industry level, reflecting those best practices and potentially at individual institution levels. And all geared towards convergence and increased compliance. When it comes to the content of the review, we have learned from our market interactions that the following topics are expected to be receiving significant attention in the early phases of the TRIM, basically till the year end of 2016. First of all, governance around topics such as model change management, use test, independence of the different parties involved, the credit risk control unit, model validation, internal audit, and so on. In this context, we would recommend to reread the Fed's letter on model risk management of April 2011, the SR letter 11.7. It is strictly speaking, of course, not applicable to the Eurozone area, but we know from personal contacts that several supervisors in the Eurozone consider it as a particularly relevant piece of regulatory benchmark. Second attention point will be data quality, the management of data quality, and the assessment of the consequences of data deficiencies. Third point of focus will be overall quality of model documentation, and in particular the explicit linking of modeling choices and regulatory requirements. For instance, we have seen a particular national supervisor use a very detailed template where banks had to map their model documentation to a predefined list of regulatory focus points. And finally, it's important to keep in mind that the SSM is a supervisor, not a regulator. As such, it works with and within the guidelines of the EBA that complement the prudential legislation. For example, when it comes to credit risk and IRB models, we expect that the November 2014 consultation paper on the supervisory assessment methodology for IRB will be important as a guiding instrument in these first few months. So to recap, focus points for the moment are governance, data, documentation, and previously announced supervisory attention points. Several of our clients indicate that it is difficult currently to get internal models approved within reasonable timelines, and they often state that in their perception, draft regulation, such as the September 2015 EBA consultation paper on the definition of default, is already influencing the way the models are assessed at present. Again, from client conversations, we hear that major attention points, or if you want, points of worry from their side, include things like evidencing appropriate involvement of senior management, the integrity of the entire RWA calculation process, the actual justification of modeling choices on the basis of regulation, evidencing as opposed to defining model use, and documentation around expert judgment and adequate conservativeness in the modeling. And of course, data, and this despite efforts done recently in the context of BCPS 239. Let me end with some key recommendations that we give to our clients. First of all, put in place a multidisciplinary task force. Mostly it is model validation or the head of validation that seems to be getting the lead, but the team should include model development, representatives from the business, the model users, internal audit, and the IT department. Secondly, make sure that some of the key resources in those teams actually lead the TRIM assignment and liaise with the supervisor. The future of supervision is being defined in this process, and it's a good learning process to be engaged in this conversation as quickly as possible. Thirdly, have a second look at some of the supervisory or regulatory publications, like the ones we mentioned before on model risk management and assessment methodology. Spend significant time on ensuring that the entire picture looks consistent and is well documented. It's not just a question of drawing together documentation. Let's take a step back and see how the total picture of how your organization is investing and living the internal models, how that comes across. And last recommendation, in particular for credit risk, is that going forward, start splitting more consciously in your mind the risk ranking and risk discrimination in the modeling from the step where the scores are mapped to PDs. Regulators have clearly expressed confidence in the former, the risk ranking aspects of the model, but they have clearly also some lack of trust in the mapping to capital requirements and default rates that are on the back of that. So, Henrik, let me stop here and hand it back to you, although I could go on for quite some time, as some of you might have gathered.
Thanks, Frank. We've already received a couple of questions on TRIM, so we're going to come back to that. And with that, handing over to David on the European Deposit Insurance Scheme developments.
Yes, thank you, Henrik. Renewed greetings to you all. The following commentary on EDIS is based on two recent events, one a lunchtime debate that I shared at the European Parliament on the 25th of April with the Dutch rapporteur, MEP Esther de Lange, the European Commission's policy officer on this piece of legislation, Patrick Pearson, and the presence of the Dutch bank ING and the French Banking Federation. And I also had a separate meeting the same day with the Deputy Director General of the European Commission's Financial Services Directorate. So in terms of background, the European Commission launched the EDIS proposal back in November 2015, which was aimed at establishing a system of insurance with a reinsurance of national deposit guarantee schemes, financed by direct contributions from banks towards a mutualized European deposit insurance fund. The rationale behind this initiative is based on the premise that the current setup of national DGSs remains vulnerable to local shocks. Continuing high levels of non-performing loans, precipitative resolutions of some failing Italian and Portuguese banks, and of course, the ever-persistent low yield-driven disappointing results of many banks across the European Union. The thinking is that a common EU-wide deposit insurance scheme would help to boost the resilience against future crises. The EDS, as Henrik has already mentioned, is the third pillar of the European Banking Union, alongside the recently established single supervisory mechanism and the single resolution mechanism. It would be mandatory for the euro area countries and open to all other member states participating in the banking union. The EDIS initiative regime would apply to all banks through risk weighting, which would result in riskier banks clearly contributing more to the scheme. A fact that is important to point out is even though the most recent European Deposit Guarantee Scheme directive had to be implemented by the 3rd of July 2015, surprisingly no less than 18 out of 28 member states have failed to implement the directive by mid-October of last year. So how will EDIS actually function? EDIS will be equivalent to 0.8% of the covered deposits of all banks in the European Union by 2024, reaching an estimated 43 billion euros of a fund. The actual precise amount to be contributed by each individual bank, however, will be determined by the European Commission in a delegated act and will take account critically of the risk profile of the individual bank. Lastly, EDIS kicks in response to two distinct scenarios. Number one, when a failing bank is liquidated and deposits need to be obviously paid out. And number two, when a failing bank is resolved and the transfer of deposits to another institution needs to be financed so that the deposit access is not disrupted. Now, moving to latest developments, as most of you probably know, this piece of legislation is still being reviewed and discussed at the European Parliament by the Influential Economic and Monetary Affairs Committee of MEPs. And indeed, it's continuing to evoke a lot of divergent views and highlighting very high political maneuvering on the issue. Two broad polarized positions seem to be emerging from these discussions. One group led by the rapporteur, Dutch MEP Esther de Lange, are urging that consideration be given to the interlinkages between EDIS and other related EU laws, notably whether the current institutions, such as the single supervisory mechanism and the single resolution mechanism, have enough tools at their disposal to do their job. Renewed concerns are emerging that the SSM regime does not cover many mid-sized but systemic banks in the EU that continue to be weak and could contribute to financial instability. And indeed, many questions about the robustness of these national institutions in overseeing some 6,000 non-SSM banks is still a persistent concern. Other concerns that have leapt up in the course of discussion of the MEPs include the fact that the Commission has not conducted an impact assessment on EDIS. Secondly, that EDIS cannot be meaningfully discussed without also addressing the level of high debt indebtedness of many member states and banks, a sort of a concomitant vulnerability factor that's being underlined. And thirdly, important work that still needs to be done in terms of risk reduction strategies to address the high legacy costs and the high levels of non-performing loans before moving on to EDIS. By the way, this view is largely shared by the European Commission. A few MEPs, especially from the Socialist Group, believe that there is simply no time left for considering the entire architecture of the European financial system. As Greek MEP Dimitros Papadimoulos MEP, summarized the sentiments by saying, quote, the longer the process is delayed, the longer Europe is at risk from systemic shocks, end of quote. The Commission, of course, endorses the view that a great many non-SSM banks, albeit with only domestic operations, still represent a factor of vulnerability and that risk reduction measures will need to be envisaged. One option is extending TLAC, probably a buffer of 18% of RWAs by 2020, beyond the G-SIBs to those mid-sized systemic banks at national level. It would be remiss of me not to mention some other vulnerabilities that are influencing this particular debate in the banking space, of course, are contributing to the slow conclusion of this particular legislative package. Number one, increasing calls to abolish or at least reduce the preferential regulatory treatment of sovereign exposures held at zero by banks. The most vocal critical element of this comes from the Bundesbank in Germany that has stated, and I quote, a great deal can be achieved here simply by ending or at least substantially scaling back the regulatory exemptions thus far afforded in sovereign debt from capital adequacy requirements and the large exposure limits, end of quote. Indeed, 10 days ago, the German finance minister refused to move to the next stage of the banking union in terms of EDIS unless there is progress in mitigating the concentration of peripheral Eurozone sovereign bonds held and designated as risk-free by domestic banks. The second factor of vulnerability is the divergent approaches to bail-in under the single resolution mechanism, notably in the last 7 months in Italy, where the issue has become one of which creditor suffers first, an issue which is proving problematic as this measure remains determined by national legislation. There have been calls for bringing forward the review of the BRRD and the SRM this year rather than wait until 2018, and pressure is building up a council to introduce a revised pecking order of bail-in covering all creditors. And, of course, the insolvency laws and restructuring procedures which need to be also converged in Europe as well. In conclusion, I think the Commission wants to move quickly on EDIS. The Dutch presidency of the European Council is hoping to achieve political agreement by June this year. Frankly, I doubt it. Agreement is very far away from being reached at the European Parliament, even before the formal trilogues began. And in spite of more recent compromises like introducing collateralized commitments and new cash contributed by banks, I have to say I'm not hopeful of a rapid conclusion until associated issues such as absorbing the NPLs, reforming risk weightings of sovereign bonds held by banks, and a revision of the SRM regime, until these have been settled, I don't see progress being made. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, David. And now over to our questions and answers session. We have received a couple of questions, actually six. If you have more questions, remember to send them bankingunion@uk.ui.com. So the first question to Frank, I think, is what's the timeline for TRIM?
Yes, so in fact, the timeline for TRIM is, as in our understanding, as follows. It is ongoing for the moment when I spoke about this fact-finding phase that is currently ongoing, and we expect that over the next 3 months, basically over the summer, there is significant information request that will land on the desks of the banks. At least that's what we understand has been announced to the individual banks involved. That will be a relatively centralized process out of Frankfurt. And then in 2017, 18, and 19, after there will be comparative studies in sectors or countries and then more in-depth reviews of individual models at individual banks, which then obviously will involve more on-site work.
Okay. Thank you, Frank. And just because I think we talked about this before this call, I mean, this should start up already July 1, correct?
Yes. Absolutely.
With credit, then market.
With credit, market, and counterparty credit already ongoing.
Okay. All right, good. So second question actually also to you, Frank. There's a clear option from the regulator to challenge the advanced IRB approach. Do you think that this will trigger a massive move to standardized tendency in the next years?
Well, the move to standardized tenancy can probably play at two levels. So first of all, I think that there are challenges with adequately modeling the so-called low default portfolio, sovereigns, banks, big corporates. That is well known, and in fact, frustration has been building up both on bank side and supervisory side on how to make sense of that. And basically, the recent Basel proposal reflects that intellectual acquis of the community. Secondly, at a supervisory level, I think if you look at the different pieces of legislation, there is a tendency to work more with floors and then actually look at modeling to see whether the standardized approach is adequate for the risk profile of the portfolio, and if not, then look for upside or extra capital charges. So from that perspective, there is clearly a tendency to rely less on the capital requirements for on internal models. However, that does not mean that one should immediately stop all developments on internal models. And again, I briefly touched upon that in the intervention earlier. Keep in mind that risk modeling always has two aspects in mind or achieves two goals. It's the rank ordering of risk to identify what risk is more important than what other risk, and that feeds into decision trees, acceptance or rejection of certain risks, escalation, limit triggers, that type of thing. And obviously, your internal models will always be expected to support that part of the risk management. It's the second layer where those models then feed into an actual capital requirement where regulation will increasingly become more constraining.
Okay, thank you, Frank. The next question I have is for Mario. Please provide recent developments regarding the calculation of MREL.
Yes, thank you, Henrik. No, as I said during the presentation, MREL, as opposed to TLAC, is set on a case-by-case basis. Therefore, we still need to see how the resolution authority approaches how much MREL is going to ask from entities. As it's widely known, there are two main components of MREL. The first one is the loss absorbing capacity, which in general is assimilated to the ordinary capital requirements, but then there is a recapitalization amount, which should deal with recapitalizing the entity up to the solvency level, ordinary solvency levels. And that's where most of the uncertainties lie. How much a recapitalization amount will be asked from entities. And that will depend on the resolution tool that's going to be used. For example, if that's going to be the sale of business or a bridge bank, then you could believe that you would need to recapitalize the whole entity as it was before resolution. And therefore, the recapitalization amount would be lower than the loss absorbing amount. On the other hand, if the entity is complex enough or big enough, probably the resolution authority would feel that the whole entity would need to recapitalize after resolution. And therefore, the loss absorbing amount, the recapitalization amount would be similar to the loss absorbing amount.
Okay, and then a related question. How do you see the MREL affecting mid-sized banks?
Yes, thank you again. That's a question that's being posed to the SRB and to National Resolution Authorities a lot, because several banks, especially smaller banks, are not so used to issuing debt. And therefore, they will need to comply with MREL, so they are faced with a clear challenge there. And the Resolution Authority, the Single Resolution Board is usually saying about this that, first of all, they intend to make MREL complied with by banks, but they also do not intend to unnecessarily harm this type of banks. And they believe that a possible way forward for them is, first of all, that the resolution tool that might be used with them will be probably a sale of business or a bridge bank, and therefore they could be impose a lower MREL requirement. And also, the phase-in to comply with MREL should facilitate them this compliance.
Okay. Thank you, Mario. David, I have a question for you. I guess I'll have to ask you to do a short one because it's a broad question. which is, can surviving banks that are meeting all these additional regulatory requirements and forking out increased sums of money to ensure compliance be considered more safe and more trustworthy?
The sentiment in Brussels, particularly during this MEP debate that I mentioned in my own intervention, is that a great many non-SSM banks, mid-sized, domestic in nature, perhaps not even having cross-border activities, but by virtue of the presence and the magnitude of their assets and the magnitude of their influence in the jurisdiction in question, are probably not as robust as they should be. And indeed, this is one of the key factors that's holding up the debate on EVs. MEPs and the Commission, I think, are beginning to share the view and align the concerns about risk reduction measures that need to be taken before we consider introducing any European deposit guarantee insurance scheme. Now, clearly, the TLAC debate will perhaps contribute to mitigating some of this issue, but it may be some time before TLAC comes into place. And the big question, of course, is, and this is a question, indeed, which has been posed at Commission level, should we extend TLAC to beyond the G-SIBs to include this category of mid-sized systemic banks across Europe? And this is, I think, a debate that's going to be hotly debated and reviewed by the European Parliament and the Council. I think the Council will probably not be widely enthusiastic about this. They will want to retain some degree of sovereignty over the remaining banks that do not fall within the remit of the SSM. But on the other hand, the MEPs and the Commission are on the same page in terms of we need to address the systemic nature of some of these banks that remain a vulnerability factor in terms of financial instability.
All right. I guess in the, we're coming up to our timeline end here. There was one additional question, which is if we could circulate the reference docs that Frank mentioned on TRIM, which is the Fed paper from 2011, and then the draft regulatory technical standards on supervisory review of credit and market risk models. And we will do that when we circulate a copy of the recording of this call. So just to sum up, from each panelist, what's sort of the main takeaway message for the audience now? 30 seconds, Frank.
I think on TRIM, it's starting. It's time to get focused, and it starts from the top down. And do pay attention that in whatever you transmit, that the overall image that the bank is taking the internal models and all the aspects of it seriously is an important consideration at this point in time.
And Mario?
Thank you, Henrik. I think the final message I would like to convey is that MREL is happening, and it's going to be part of the entity's life now. So the areas in which they can work on to prepare for that is information systems, financial planning, and, of course, working on resolvability. Thank you.
All right. David?
Yeah, as I said earlier, I think the Aegis project is going to undergo a prolonged stalemate until the issues are associated issues like absorbing the non-performing loans, the whole reform and revision perhaps of the SRM regime, particularly in relation to which creditors get hit first, and last but not least, the reforming the risk weightings of sovereign bonds. And this will also, I think, have implications in terms of the EBA's recent issuing of guidelines on stress testing for deposit guarantee schemes, which I think will be held up as well in the light of the discussions that are being held at the European Parliament. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all. So that ends today's call. I'd like to thank you, our panelists, for your insights, and also you, the audience, for joining. We will, as usual, be sending out an audio recording of this call and with the documents referred to by Frank, the Fed guideline and the RTSs, and also David Doyle has a Wake Up to Brussels deck, which basically highlights the features of the latest financial services regulatory agenda. We'll send that along with the audio file as well. If you'd like to reach out to anyone on the panel to discuss any of these issues further, please send us an email, bankingunion@uk.ey.com, as mentioned earlier. Our next call will be taking place in September due to the summer period coming up shortly. So thank you again for joining us, and we wish you a pleasant day. Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the EY Banking Union conference call. Thank you all for your participation today. You may now disconnect.